asked the receptionist for my clinic list. He looked a little embarrassed as he turned over one of the blank sheets of paper to reveal another sheet beneath with a list of the patients coming to see me.
Corporate outpatient management has said we must keep the patients' names covered to preserve confidentiality, he said. There's some target for it. We've been told to do it.
I called out the name of the first patient in a loud voice, looking round at the assembled patients waiting to see me. A young man and an elderly couple hurriedly got up from their chairs, anxious and deferential in the way we all are when we go to see doctors. How's that for confidentiality? I muttered to the hapless receptionist. Maybe the patients should be identified only by numbers, like in a VD clinic. I turned away from the reception desk. I'm Henry Marsh, I said to the young man as he came up to me, becoming a kind and polite surgeon instead of an impotent and angry victim of government targets. Please follow me. We walked round to the office, his elderly parents following us. He was a young policeman who had suffered an epileptic fit several weeks ago, suddenly out of the blue, changing his life forever. He was taken to his local A&E department, where a brain scan showed a tumour. He had recovered from the fit, and as the tumour was a small one, he was sent home and a referral made to the regional neurosurgical centre. It took a while for the referral letter to be passed on to me, so we had to wait 2 weeks before we finally met. 2 weeks waiting to hear, in effect, whether he would live or die, since none of his local doctors would have known enough about brain tumours to be able to interpret the scan with any confidence. "Do please sit down," I said, indicating the three chairs in front of my desk with its tower of notes and slow computer. I went over the history of the fit briefly with him and his family. As is usually the case with epilepsy, it had been more frightening for his mother, who had witnessed the fit, than for the man himself. "I thought he was going to die," she said. "He stopped breathing, and his face went blue, though he was better by the time the ambulance came. I just remember waking up in the hospital. I then had the scan," the young policeman said. "I've been fearing the worst since then." His face was desperate with the hope that I could save him, and the fear that I might not. "Let's look at the scan," I said. I'd seen it 2 days earlier, but I see so many scans every day that I have to have them immediately in front of me whenever I see a patient, if I am not to make a mistake. "This may take a while," I added. "The scans are on the computer network of your local hospital, and this is then linked over the net to our system." As I spoke, I typed on the keyboard, looking for the icon for his hospital's X-ray network. I found it and summoned up a password box. I have lost count of the number of different passwords I now need to get my work done every day. I spent 5 minutes failing to get into the system. I was painfully aware of the anxious man and his family watching my every move, waiting to hear if I would be reading him his death sentence or not. "It was so much easier in the past," I sighed, pointing at the redundant light screen in front of my desk. "Just 30 seconds to put an X-ray film up onto the X-ray screen. I've tried every bloody password I know." I could have added that the previous week I had had to send 4 of the 12 patients home from the clinic without having been able to see their scans, so that the appointments had been entirely wasted and the patients made even more anxious and unhappy. "It's just like this with the police force," the patient said. "Everything's computerised and we're constantly being told what to do, but nothing works as well as it used to." I rang Gail, but she was unable to solve the problem. She gave me the number of the X-ray department, but when I tried it, I only got an answering machine in reply. "Excuse me," I said. "I'll go upstairs to see if I can get one of the X-ray secretaries to help." So I hurried past the waiting patients in the subterranean waiting room and ran up the 2 flights of stairs to the X-ray department. It is quicker than going by the lifts, and without a condescending voice telling me to wash my hands. "Where is Caroline?" I shouted as I arrived at the X-ray reception desk, a little out of breath.
"Well, she's about somewhere," came the reply. So I headed off round the department, and eventually I found her and explained the problem. "Have you tried your password?" "Yes, I bloody well have." "Well, try Mr. Johnston's. That usually works. Fuck off 45. He hates computers." "Why 45? "It's the 45th month since we signed on to that hospital system, and one has to change the password every month," Caroline replied. So I ran down the corridor and down the stairs and past the waiting patients back to the consultation room. "Apparently the best password is fuck off 45, I told the patient and his parents, who were still waiting to hear his possible death sentence. They laughed nervously. I duly typed in fuck off 45, but having thought about it, and having told me that it was checking my credentials, the computer told me that the password was not recognised. I tried typing in fuck off 45 in many different ways, uppercase, lowercase, with spaces, without spaces. I typed in fuck off 44 and fuck off 46, but without success. I ran back upstairs a second time, followed by the curious, anxious eyes of the patients in the waiting area. The clinic was now running late, and the number of patients waiting to see me was steadily growing. I went back to the X-ray department and found Caroline at her desk. I told her that fuck off 45 did not work. "Well," she sighed, "I'd better come and look. Maybe you don't know how to spell fuck off." We went downstairs together and returned to the consultation room. "Now that I think of it," she said, "it might have become fuck off 47. She typed in fuck off 47, and the computer, having checked my credentials, although they were really Mr. Johnston's, to its satisfaction, finally downloaded the menu for the X-ray department at the patient's hospital. "Sorry about that," Caroline said with a laugh as she left the room. "I should have thought of that myself," I said, feeling very stupid as I downloaded the patient's brain scans. It may have taken a long time to get the brain scans onto the computer screen, but it did not take long to interpret them. The patient's scan showed an abnormal area, a little like a small white ball pressing on the left side of his brain. "Well," I said, knowing what had been preying on his mind for the last 2 weeks, and more particularly over the past 50 minutes, "it doesn't look like cancer. I think everything's going to be okay." All three of them sat back a little in their chairs as I said this, and the mother reached out for her son's hand, and they smiled to each other. I felt considerable relief myself. I often have to reduce people to tears as they sit opposite me in the outpatient room. I explained to them that the tumour was almost certainly benign and that he would need an operation to remove it. I added, a little apologetically, that the operation had some serious risks. In a reassuring tone of voice, I explained that the risk of leaving him paralysed down the right side of the body, as though he'd had a stroke and maybe unable to speak, was not more than 5%. "It would sound very different if instead," I said, "as much as 5%, in a suitably grim tone. "All operations have risks," said his father, "as almost everybody does at this stage of the discussion." I agreed, but pointed out that some risks are more serious than others, and the trouble with brain surgery is that even if little things go wrong, the consequences can be catastrophic. If the operation goes wrong, it's a 100% disaster rate for the patient, but still only 5% for me. They nodded mutely. I went on to say that the risks of the operation were very much smaller than the risks of doing nothing and letting the tumour get bigger. Eventually,